Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Mark McGuinness. Mark is an award-winning poet based in Bristol, United Kingdom. On his podcast, A Mouthful of Air, he interviews contemporary poets about the writing process behind their poems. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. I'm glad you're here. Could I ask you if you could read one of your poems for us?
Sure. So this is a sonnet, and it is called Chrysalis, as in the transformative process between a caterpillar and a butterfly. And this is in the voice of the butterfly looking back on that process. Chrysalis. The hard part isn't spinning my own shroud to cover me from head to toes, then waiting for my dozen eyes to cloud, my segments to collapse like dominoes. Yet neither is it fetid dissolution, my liquidized flesh, my petrifying shell, or the agonizing slow reconstitution from serpent into angel via gel. The hard part isn't being born again inside a wrapper like a folded kite, unfolding and assembling struts and stems, or hoisting the whole contraption into flight. The hardest part is where it all begins, relinquishing legs for fantasies of wings.
That's great. I'm curious, do you remember the impetus that drove you to write that poem?
Yes, I do very clearly, this one. No, it's not always as dramatic as this, but actually this one was, it kind of came to me in the middle of the night. I remember it was like a dream that was so vivid that I wasn't sure if I was awake or asleep. And it was almost like this, the image of this entity that was speaking to me. It was almost like it was coming through the ceiling. And I wish I could say poetry was always this dramatic, but it's not. But on this occasion, it was. And it was, you know, looking back, it was a time when I was going through a process of big change in my work and in my life. And so I don't think it's rocket science to, you know, to see the parallels between the, you know, the transformation from the caterpillar into the butterfly. But having said that, you know, it didn't arrive fully formed. I had the basic idea and I kind of knew it would be a sonnet, but it took quite a lot of drafts before I got it into this current form.
Well, I'm curious, what was your own personal writing journey that led you to your interest in writing poetry and then led to your podcast, where you interview poets?
It depends how far back you want to go. I can remember being entranced by nursery rhymes and children's verse, nonsense verse, when I was really small. In fact, one of the first poems I've read on the podcast is The Jumblies by Edward Lear. You know, they went to sea in a sieve, they did, in a sieve they went to sea. And, you know, because I remember that, I was obsessed by that when I was really quite small. And then when I was a teenager, I think that was the point where I got seriously interested in poetry. I think what we would call secondary school, maybe your listeners might call high school, is almost like the fork in the road if people love or hate poetry. I think a lot of people get put off. But I was really lucky. I had two wonderful English teachers, Sue Dove and Jeff Riley. And we would spend a whole lesson looking at one or two poems. And I was just spellbound by the fact that you could look at this little block of text and you could spend an hour looking at it and talking about it, and you would still be finding new things at the end of the hour because the language was so concentrated. And that was the point where I started writing, and they were encouraging me to write. And I thought, okay, this is what I want to do. But that's a long time. There's a long gap between that and, you know, the reading and the writing that I've done over the years to get to the point where I launched the podcast last year. And I think You know, there were several things that went into the podcast. One of them was, you know, I was approaching 50, which is always a point where I think one takes stock and looks up and thinks, well, what am I doing or what have I done with my life? And one of the things I noticed, I've got this behind me, I've got these several bookshelves full of poetry that are my treasure, if you like, my memory bank. And I thought, you know, isn't it a shame if it just stops with me, if I read all those poems and I enjoy them? But, you know, I just had this urge to take some books down from the shelf and start reading them and sharing them. And, you know, touching on the fact that a lot of people get put off poetry early in life, or they think it's not for them, or it's this thing that's up on the pedestal. Unsurprisingly, most of the time, I am the person in my group of friends or my social circle who I'm the one who reads poetry, because most people don't. And I think it's not that hard for people to get it. It's not. It really isn't an academic subject. I know they tried to turn it into one, but that's not where poetry came from. And I just think, you know, if I could take a poem down from the shelf and read it and say to people, look, isn't this wonderful? Like, have you noticed what the poet's done here? And how do you feel when you hear that? And really just get people to trust their own response to the poem, and hopefully to get some of the pleasure and the sustenance that I get from the poems. So that was one big spark for the podcast. I think another one was spending years and years sitting beside other poets in classes and hearing so many wonderful poems. You know, I would often go to Mimi Calvati, my long-term mentor, go to her writing workshop and just be listening to poem after poem and thinking, what a wonderful evening entertainment I'm getting from all these people around the table. And I thought, you know, this should be more widely known, you know. So at this point, I know quite a lot of poets. And I think it's a challenge for all of us to break out of that poetry bubble, that poetry circle, the people who read and write. There's a very high percentage of poetry readers are also writers. And I just thought, well, what I would love to do is invite some of these poets onto the show, get them to read a poem, and then I will ask them some questions about it. So, you know, if I'm doing a Shakespeare sonnet that I can't really ask him, I have to kind of make it up myself. But if it's a contemporary poet, I get them to read a poem, and then I'll ask them, you know, well, the same question you asked me, actually, where did this poem come from? And then how did it evolve during the writing process? So I think what you end up with because of these two sources on the podcast is something old, something new. You get a lot of traditional classic poems that I'm reading, and then we get the cutting edge contemporary work from the guest poets.
That's great. Well, what do you think novelists or short story writers can gain from either reading poetry or writing their own poems?
So Stephen Pressfield had a really great piece on his blog a few years ago, where he said, most writers are, in their heart of hearts, they're either story smiths or word smiths. And I think my impression is that a lot of novelists, they're more likely to be story smiths at heart, certainly more than the poets. I mean, I could name names, but some poets, they write what are supposed to be long narrative poems. And it's like, well, okay, but where is the story? So, you know, there's something that poets can certainly learn, I think, from novelists about story smithing, about narrative structure, character arc, plot development, and so on. But I think an obvious, you know, corollary of that is poets tend to be the wordsmiths. We're the ones obsessed by finding the right word or even the right punctuation mark on a particular line. And we will take it out and put it in and take it out and put it in and just tweak it and tweak it and tweak it for years, which is really how I write poems. And most poets I know, that's generally how they work. So I think probably the obvious answer is that close attention to language, which, you know, ideally, I think what we're all looking for is to be the wordsmith and the story smith, or the, you know, good at the detail and the bigger picture and the bigger structure. So I would say, and it's certainly one thing I try and do on the podcast, is really get people to listen to the actual words that a poet uses and the rhythm of the word, the sound of the word, the feeling, the cadence. Because if you can combine that, you know, that's what will draw a reader in to a, say, an individual scene, is the texture of the language. But obviously, and if you can combine that with a compelling, you know, a good yarn, a compelling plot, then you're going to have such a powerful book, I think.
That's great. I'm curious, what is method writing, and can you explain how that works?
Well, this is a term that came up in one of the interviews with a poet called Shazia Qureshi, who wrote a poem called The Taxidermist, and it includes some pretty graphic descriptions of taxidermy on a mouse and also a hummingbird, I think. There may be some other creatures in there as well. And I naively said to Shazia, so, well, you know, this seems awfully realistic, these descriptions of taxidermy. How on earth did you manage to get it so accurate? And she said, well, I signed up for a taxidermy course. And I went and did some. And, I mean, I should stress, Shazia was very clear that apparently there is a thing called ethical taxidermy and even ethical feminist taxidermy, where people are very careful to make sure that nobody's going out and shooting and killing live creatures in order to taxiderm them. I don't know if that's the right use of the verb. So it's got to be that it died a natural death. It was found, you know, so there's no kind of ethical issue around that. But that said, you know, and also Shazia said that when she took the course, she realized, and she looked into this field, there's a whole field of art taxidermy. And what she discovered is that, you know, I guess the feminist aspect comes from the old idea that, you know, it's slightly patriarchal, imperialist, you know, chaps in pith helmets going out from Britain and shooting big things and putting them up on the wall. And apparently the feminist artistic take on it is it's more about, I think Shazia had a lovely line in one of her poems about honoring these brief lives, which was such a beautiful phrase, I thought. And so she said it's quite an unpleasant thing to do because it's basically butchery. But what she got from that was a really fabulous poem sequence. So sometimes, you know, and I was joking that this is method writing, a bit like Daniel Day-Lewis's method acting, that if you're going to write about something, you know, you've got to go and do it and live it. So I really admired her commitment on that. I'm certainly not going to follow her down that path.
Transform your home in one weekend with paint from Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in One offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening, smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today. Save big money
at Menards. What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Well, some people have a desire to write, but they just can't seem to come up with ideas. I'm curious, are there free write or creativity exercises that you would recommend for someone to kind of free up their ideas and writing muscles?
I think there are lots of them. I'm just talking my own personal experience. I never really get on very well with anything that's based around content. But weirdly enough, if you give me a form to write in, if you say, oh, here's an exotic troubadour form that we've just discovered with a strange rhyme scheme, then I'm going to be all over it, because there's something about the technical challenge that makes it easier for me to just focus on getting words on a page. And in a strange way, that seems to open the door to my kind of subconscious or my imagination, that's when the interesting stuff kind of comes in. So I think I would suggest, think about writing in an unusual form. It doesn't have to be a poetic form. It could be, so Rowan Evans, a wonderful poet from here in Bristol, where I live, he came on the podcast and he brought a poem that he said was a mixtape. And I don't know if maybe some of your listeners may be too young to remember mixtapes, but back in the day, though, you know, the mixtape.
Oh, I remember them.
Okay, right. So you can understand the cultural significance of that, right? So it's when you hear stuff on the radio and you rush to the tape recorder and when the first chords of it come along and you start recording it, or you might do a tape to tape or record an LP, and you create your own compilation. I guess the equivalent is the playlist now. And so this poem is called it Cante Hondo Mixtape. So Cante Hondo was a poem by the Spanish poet Federico García Lorca. And it was a kind of a mashup of what Rowan had got from reading that poem, but also traveling on a train, mainly through Spain, and all the different impressions that he'd got. And he'd kind of just put them together in this very impressionistic poem, one little scene after another, and he called it a mixtape. So, you know, maybe for a listener, if you're feeling stuck and you think, well, I'm not quite sure what to write about or what to get going on, maybe I will do a mixtape. I'll do a mixtape of the last year. I'll do a mixtape of the pandemic. I'll do a mixtape of, I don't know, my favorite moments from movies or other media. So, you know, what I would, you know, just think about maybe finding a form. It could be an obituary. It could be a recipe. It could be an instruction manual, something that you would never normally write in. And I would say have a go at that, because, you know, paradoxically, when you're focused on the form, when you're focused on the structure of the words, it's as though that little critical self-censoring guard can come down, because it's distracted. And then that's when the interesting stuff can start to flow into the writing.
I'm curious, can you discuss the importance of embracing nonsense in writing?
Well, you're talking to a poet, so nonsense is never far away, right? I think, you know, so the Jumblies is the poem that I've used on the podcast as an example of really great nonsense. So just so that we know where we are, this is the first verse. They went to sea in a sieve, they did, in a sieve they went to sea. In spite of all their friends could say, on a winter's morn, on a stormy day, in a sieve they went to sea. And when the sieve turned round and round, and everyone cried, you'll all be drowned, they called aloud, our sieve ain't big, but we don't care a button, we don't care a fig, in a sieve we'll go to sea. Far and few, are the lands where the Jumblies live. Their heads are green and their hands are blue, and they went to sea in a sieve. Now, on one level, I that clearly is nonsense. I mean, you can't go to a sea in a sieve. And, you know, what does it mean? You know, their heads are green and their hands are blue. What's going on there? But I think we can all pick up. It's like a dance, you know, that you get caught up in it. And you want to move. And it's a bit silly and it's a bit frivolous, but actually there's a real physical, first of all, there's a real physical pleasure, I think, in the rhythm, in the rhyme, in the beat of a poem like this. And you're letting go of the nonsense, and that will take you away somewhere in your imagination that you couldn't get to logically. And, you know, even though it's obviously complete nonsense, I think maybe as creatives we can relate to this, because if you're a writer, I think really you're always going to see in a sieve. You know, it certainly, if you think about the financial implications of it, but even if you just think about the imaginative thing, it's so daunting. The sea is so wide. So many people have already done so much. And yet I have the temerity to think that in my little sieve, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to cross that ocean and I'm going to discover something amazing and bring it back and I won't be drowned. And, you know, that call to adventure, I think, is really what this poem is about. And, you know, it can wake up that adventurous part of us that maybe we remember from childhood and that I think is still there for us as adults if we're not, you know, if we don't take ourselves so seriously that we wouldn't, you know, bend over and cross the threshold and read a poem like this.
That's great. Well, what writing advice would you offer for listeners who may be working on their own poems or novels or short stories?
The first thing is an obvious thing, which is read lots of what you do. The thing that you want to write, read as much of that as you can. So a recent example of that was I'm working on my poetry collection, and I realized I wanted a ballad in that collection. And so the Jumblies, which I've just read, is a basically ballad meter Ed Lear is using there. And I wanted a poem a bit like that. And I had no idea what it would be about. So I just trusted my unconscious. I got a big anthology of ballads, the Faber Book of Ballads. And I read the whole thing from cover to cover. And I just trusted that my unconscious mind would get the hint. And sure enough, at 4 o'clock one morning, I woke up and I had an idea for a ballad. And I started to write it right there in bed at 4 o'clock in the morning, which was really inconvenient because I wanted to go back to sleep because I had work the next day. But, you know, sometimes we need to suffer for our art. So I think that would be my first thing, is just read a load of the thing that you want to write. And if that feels like a chore, then maybe that's a sign you should be writing something else, because, you know, you can't write something unless you really love that form, whether it's a detective story or, you know, romantic fiction or science fiction or whatever. You've got to be able to geek out on it. And if not, then ask yourself, well, what do I want to geek out on, even if that doesn't seem such a sensible choice. And then the other end of the spectrum is getting really good feedback. And I mean from somebody who really knows what they're doing. In my case, I've been really lucky to have Mimi Calvati, one of our most distinguished poets over here, as a mentor and a teacher for many years. I've also made it my business to get feedback from other poets, editors, publishers, you know, on occasion, because you've got to be able to calibrate what you think you've put on the page with what other people are picking up from the page. And it's not always the same thing, you know, because very often I would take a poem and Mimi would critique it and I would say, no, but what I meant was, and she said, well, that's all very well, but that's not what you wrote. In my mind, it was all there on the page. And she got me to realize, no, you haven't quite got there yet. So I think those would be my two main things. And then in between, you've got all kinds of different schools of thought about how you get started and whether you should be a plotter or a pantser or, you know, how free or how loose you should be in the process. But I think if you do those two things, then you probably can't go too far wrong. And also don't be afraid, you know, the bit in the middle, don't be afraid to do it your way. Like, for instance, I'm no good with prompts based on content, but I discovered that I can write starting from the form end of the stick. So that's what I do.
That's good. Well, what poetry collections or novels or nonfiction books have you read recently that you enjoyed?
Let's see. Well, right now I'm looking on my desk. I have just finished reading Malaika Booker's collection, Pepper Seed. She was on the podcast recently. That's a really wonderful collection based on her experience as being a British writer, but she's also got Guyanese and Trinidadian parentage. So she's got a real window from British culture to the Caribbean and back. I'm also just starting Dana Joyer, 99 Poems New and Selected, which is one of your really top American contemporary poets. And it's very much in my wheelhouse. He really knows what to do with meter and rhythm and rhyme, which is, it's not quite a lost art, but it's a bit of a minority pursuit these days. And I'm very much in favor of that. So, by the way, if anybody is still hesitant about, you know, what's going on in contemporary poetry and does it really relate to life, to my life in the way that maybe fiction does, Google Dana Joyer's article for The Atlantic called Can Poetry Matter, where he has quite a provocative take on what went wrong with poetry, particularly in the States, when it became quite the preserver of the academy and creative writing classes. And he's got makes a very passionate case that poetry should be part of everybody's reading, everybody's cultural life, the way novels and movies and music are.
Well, where can people find you online if they'd like to learn more about you and your podcast and your poetry?
The podcast is called A Mouthful of Air, which I'm told is a great title, and it should be because I stole it from Yeats. And you can find that on the usual podcast platforms, A Mouthful of Air, or online at amouthfulofair.fm. If anybody's interested in my poetry, you can find me at markmcguinness.com. And that's Guinness spelt like the drink, GUINNESS.
That's great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Mark McGuinness, poet and host of the podcast, A Mouthful of Air. Check out his poems and go subscribe to his podcast today. And Mark, thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it. You've got some great questions. So thank you, Jeff.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at HereYouAreAZ.com.